As you've heard from my little 30-second blurb, I'm going to be talking about academia and its current, I would say, still pretty amber and orange kind of levels of development, which certainly preclude any kind of integrality. So that's why we're still homeless as integral researchers. Homeless in terms of where do you fit? Like your disciplinary home, there isn't one. Like at my university, I'm nowhere. So that kind of lack of membership, of course, is also lack of power. In terms of grants, same thing. Those are still pretty disciplinary kind of focused. So the orthodoxy, and the second thing is the competition. Now, two levels of competition. One is between universities. So that has really made academia extremely orange. We have targets, we have algorithmic surveillance and evaluation of everything we do in those terms. And because of that, and because of the direct impact on performance assessment, we also get this, right? There's no collegiality because everybody's your competitor. And so it's pretty damn hard to be integral or anything given that, right? So that's where we're at. And why is it worth fighting for? Well, there's so much talk about transdisciplinarity now in view of us being pretty disciplinary. And so people talk about it, but don't really have a good clue as to what that is. Now, some people, like from the upper right quadrant, immediately prescribe some kind of a model. So cut things up, right? So that's not going to do it. And otherwise, people sort of call anything, if you do a little bit with somebody else, it's transdisciplinary. So it's kind of loosey-goosey that way. Or whoever holds the grant is really the final decision maker in the transdisciplinary process. So integral will give you that coherent, actually, model, consistent, transparent. I hate that word because it's a fake word in academia. When they say transparent, you know, it's like under the communist regime that used to be in Europe, you know. We know, right? Okay, so this integral, IMP, Integral Methodological Pluralism, also gives you a really clear map of methodologies and what goes where, so that you actually guard against bias as well, your own bias. Because we all like one quadrant better than the others. That's where we usually start, right? So we want to spread out to all four. The other thing that's pretty cool about integral is that you can actually track fluidity, which is the problem with the lower right. Complexity is fluid. So how does it look? Now, you know this model, right? What does it actually mean? So the quadrants, which give you the perspectives. Wilbur calls them in various names, but simply subjective, objective, intersubjective, interobjective. And really, if those are the world views, that's pretty clear to understand, right? Whereas academics usually do this, right? It's existentialism, realism, relativism, pluralism. What the hell is that? Well, it depends, right? What philosopher you've been reading or haven't, because we say we do, but that's long gone. We don't read them. So we have these words, right, that are kind of hanging around, and it's magic, right? Makes us appear smart, but we actually don't know what we're doing. It's much simpler to actually use the clear words like subjective, objective, etc., right? It's a little easier to understand. And so in academic terms, then, to translate it, the quadrants are the ontology, right? How the worldview. We also talk about epistemologies. Sometimes it's a superfluous word. Again, some people don't really understand it, but you throw it in because it looks good. If you're a PhD student doing your candidacy, you damn well better throw that word in and hope that it sticks somewhere. And so the kinds of things that that we would call epistemologies are those in the blue. But essentially, the idea from IMP perspective is you have a worldview, and that with that worldview logically comes an approach to your problem. So if your worldview is from the inside, then you're going to be using an approach where you actually talk to people and ask them for their inside, right? If you're coming at it from the scientific perspective, you're going to be observing, weighing, measuring, counting, do all those external contours. And then in the lower left, you talk to people, right? So here is the constructivism, interpretivism, how do we understand each other, etc. And then in the lower right, nobody knows. So we kind of say systems, we say systems theory or something like that, and make it sound good. But that's kind of how we, the language we use, as opposed to the simplicity of IMP. But you have to have that magic, right? So beyond that, what's really useful in the integral model is the zones, because it further teases out the perspectives. And this is really, really, really helpful, because in a lot of ways, even if people talk about using the subjective ontology, let's say, in whatever language, but subjective, they may be lumping together talking to the person in a phenomenological way, where you want to get their stuff and you stay out of the way. But often academics mix that up with hermeneutics, where I take your stuff and then I put in my stuff and we put it together and have some new meaning. But very often people talk about the subjective, but really are using intersubjective methodologies, because it's just not clear. So this is what it kind of looks like if you tease it out. So in the upper left, you have phenomenology. And you should actually stick to that and really just get the goods from that person. How do you feel about this? What is your experience? And stay out of the way. In the lower left, then, you have that hermeneutics or narrative inquiry. Looking from the outside, you could be doing a case study, ethnography, action research. Okay, so you're in the collective, but now you're looking at it more from the outside. I forgot in the upper left, if you're looking at autoethnography, autobiography, all of those, it's really the structure of the language that the person uses about themselves that you can also use for analysis. In the upper right, it's the usual. I'm not going to go into the cognitive stuff, getting hooked up with sensors, etc. But for us in education, it's more the behaviorism and its measurements, right? So you give people questionnaires, and if you give lots of people questionnaires, then it becomes more reliable, etc., right? So that's what we do. There is one little interesting one, grounded theory, which was created by psychologists who were definitely upper right, but they had this idea, outrageous idea, that maybe if we talk to a few people first and get some sense of, you know, what people think, then maybe we can draw up a better questionnaire and then ask hundreds of people, right? Wow, this was a big deal because you're, you know, putting in a little bit of this personal subjective view stuff that, you know, again, you know, that's a different discipline, and really the scientific is the only one that counts, so, right? And so the lower rate is the problem. So there are a couple of things on the inside. Actor network theory is one. It's more of a historical method, using both people and objects or events as given equal value, like all of the in the mix, what's happened in this whatever problem. And systems theory, complexity, again, you know, that's where it gets a little mysterious as to how we do this. There was one, you may hear, you know, what about mixed methods research? This was a big deal, and I only mention it just to show you the kind of orthodoxy that rules in academia. So there were a bunch of folks who decided that there would be a fifth ontology, pragmatism, and that maybe sometimes when you're working on a problem, it would actually be kind of useful to talk to people, but also to measure them and put it together. Now, this seems like a simple thing, but it took absolute huge fights. I mean, careers were destroyed over this. In the American Educational Research Association, there were just huge, very acrimonious kind of academic discussions about this. And this is just, you know, mixed up methods, and this is bullshit. You don't do this. These folks persisted, and they were calling it the third way. They shouldn't have done that, maybe, but anyway. But they also gave a lot of attention to, because they were trying to justify this horrible idea of going across disciplines, that they took so much time to justify exactly how you combine the methods. So they were really coming at it from the methods. And that was the problem, because they forgot about the ontologies. Also, as you can see, what they did was put the left-hand side, all of the methodologies into one bag. They call it qualitative. And then all of the right-hand side into another bag, quantitative. Now, the problem becomes that you have very different ontologies that are playing out here. And then, as a PhD student, when you're asked on your exam, why did you use this method or that method? Because I followed the rules of mixing. But then, why, like, what was underneath that, right? And the ontologies just fell out of the picture. So it was hard for people to justify what they were doing. So start with the worldview, right? Start with the quadrants to clarify where you're going with this and how you're looking at the problem. And in IMP, Integral Methodological Pluralism, you want to make sure that you carefully outline the approach from each quadrant, but it is not a matter of four silos, of course. So that's something else that needs to be kept in mind. So you start out with your question, your quadrant, then your question, and then what methodologies would fit that question, right? If you were doing the whole research design, you would have at least four big research questions, and underneath that, of course, you'd have more, and you may have one or two methodologies in each quadrant, right? Now, here's where the fluid part comes in. You have to start somewhere, right? So Which quadrant are you going to dig in first in terms of, you know, where you start your project? So you may do a survey just to see what the big picture is. And from that, maybe you had questions prepared for the upper left, but you realize from the survey that actually you've missed a bunch of issues that, you know, you didn't anticipate, but all these people told you about. So then you need to actually adjust your questions. Add or whatever, subtract, to reflect that reality, right? And you collect data from the subjective, and then maybe you go into intersubjective, or maybe you go back into, you know, it depends what your data tell you before you move to the next thing. So you're constantly interacting, and you're collecting information. So where's the rest of it in this, right? So then the rest of it is, first of all, in the questions themselves, like the questions that you may have in the questionnaires or interviews should draw out things like levels or types or states, whatever you're working with. So that's number one, in the design. But when you get your information and you pull out, you condense it into themes, then you are looking for, this is from one of my students who did mindfulness, in teaching mindfulness in schools. So you pull out these themes and then you see how they talk to each other. So how the quadrants talk to each other, that's actually transdisciplinarity. And for example, this student found that even though, let's say at the school and system level, the policies said, yeah, you should be looking at areas of self-development, including mindfulness, etc. And so the school went along to have mindfulness classes and all of this. Then the results came out of like the lead tables, you know, where you rank schools. And all of a sudden, this school where everybody was happy and meditating and all of this, they were a few percentages below their competitor school. Guess what happened to all the mindfulness stuff? It was like immediately, and PhD student said, it was like invisible, and yet, as soon as it acted, everything was over. There is another example of the quadrants talking to each other, and again, identifying gaps, which is where you can see what's what may be happening, where it lives in terms of the problem. And if you were to look at transdisciplinarity in this way again, so transdisciplinarity means you're talking across disciplines, across ontologies, right? Across worldviews, back and forth. They inform each other, so it's not like a static thing. You could also, this is handy dandy, you can also take your literature in a particular, say, research area and put it on a little map. So when you go to your final exam and they ask you, then you can be very smart. So, the end.